This is the Public Radio Hour, our weekly mix of podcasts and homemade radio features about the Tennessee Valley and beyond. This hour, we'll get tips on how to tell a great story from The Moth's Catherine Burns.
All that audience wants is for you to be real. The number one quality of a great storyteller is their willingness to be vulnerable.
We'll also get cosmic with podcasts by Earthdate and Planetary Radio and hear about the past and future of our exploration of Mars. Then we'll finish our series on end-of-life issues as we hear the story of one family's experience letting go of a loved one with help from hospice.
I will forever be thankful to my friend and to what hospice allows you to have. Through something that's such a tragic event to lose a child, we were able to have something that was very beautiful and sacred with our daughter.
This radio hour is produced by WLRH staff and volunteers. Here we go, starting with this news update. This is 89.3 Huntsville, and you're listening to the Public Radio Hour, our weekly mix of podcasts and homemade radio features. I'm Brett Tannehill. Right now, right this second, some amazing storytelling has just begun with The Moth main stage at Randolph School's Thurber Arts Center. Live shows like this one are used to build one of our most popular shows, The Moth Radio Hour. The Moth's artistic director, Catherine Burns, says the storytelling tradition remains strong because people want and need a sense of connection.
Well, you know, we live in this digital age, and I don't think there's any surprise that The Moth and other storytelling organizations like it, you guys have the wonderful Stories Under the Stars here in Huntsville. So, of course, The Moth didn't invent storytelling, but there has been this rise in the last 20 years of, you know, these storytelling shows where people are coming out, they're telling true stories from their life on stage, like sort of taking kitchen table stories and putting them on stage and recognizing them as art. And I don't think there's any surprise that this has come up hand in hand with the digital age. Because even as we're like communicating and like typing things with our thumbs, like our, my little box across town and my friend's little box, that there's this strong desire to be as human beings, to sit in a room and actually hear one person tell an extended story about something that's important to them from their life.
What is it about the story being true that gives it an extra sense of power and connection?
Well, first of all, I think there's something really fun in true stories. Like personally, as someone who directs stories, I always say like there's a reason I'm not a fiction writer. I think it's much more interesting to try to create a brilliant story from what really happened. You know, in fiction, you can just throw in any little thing and make it be perfect. They always say that truth is stranger than fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's, to me, it's much more fun working with the truth, even if the truth isn't always convenient. So that's one thing. I also think we live in a world where stories are so filtered. You know, we turn on the news and there's a reporter telling what happened, or you go to a Hollywood movie and there's actors reading lines. Then, like, there are literally thousands and thousands of people sometimes in the credit of a big Hollywood movie. And there's something so nice about hearing what happened directly from the source. You know, when a person is telling a true story from their own life, you're hearing from the eyewitness.
Tell us a little about The Moth main stage, which we're hosting here in Huntsville tonight, and how it connects to The Moth Radio Hour. The Moth main stage feeds stories to The Moth Radio Hour. Is that right?
Exactly. So we do about 45 main stage shows a year around the country. For each one, we invite five people, ideally from all walks of life, to come tell a 10, 12-minute story on stage in front of a live audience. We record all of these shows. Sometimes we'll take a show and we'll take maybe the three stories that worked well. If that, you know, there's always like the time you have to make everything come and radio come out to 53 minutes. But we'll take a live show and edit it down and just actually put that out live with a live host. But usually not. Usually we take the individual stories and then piece together hour-long radio shows that we think are fun. Some of the stories do come from the main stage, but we also have open mic story slam competitions that happen around the world. We have a community program where we do workshops in underserved communities. We have an amazing high school slam program in New York City. And so stories from all of these programs feed the radio show, which is ultimately, hopefully, the best of all of these programs.
So many people love to hear stories, but so many are also afraid to tell their own story. So as you're coaching storytellers for their live performance, what sort of advice do you give them as they pull their stories together?
One of our rules is, this is just a tip for storytelling, is to memorize your first line and memorize your last line. Why is that? Because when you go out on stage, people are you're so nervous. And if you know exactly where you're going to start, it gets you going past that just initial panic, like, oh my God, why did I agree to do this? It'll push you through that. And then the audience, wherever you go, it's not just the moth. Storytelling audiences are the best audiences in the world. And they will always just sort of rise up and lift up the storyteller in such a beautiful way. And then they're off. And at the end, we just find that people don't memorize their last line. Even the most seasoned raconteurs will suddenly say, well, I guess that's my story. And just wander off stage. And we're like, no, really land your story. So we encourage that. But in between, we encourage people to just let it flow. People always want to memorize their stories, especially writers. They want to write it down and memorize it. But we find that doesn't make the best story. Better to just like learn bullet points and get up there and let it flow. And here's why. It's because all that audience wants is for you to be real. The number one quality of a great storyteller is their willingness to be vulnerable and to be up there and be really open, you know, to not tell the story about the time you were a hero. Tell the story about the time you really messed up. Because if you can talk about messing up, we're all going to relate to that because everybody in the audience has messed up a few times. And so we, you know, people are always nervous that they're going to forget their place. And we're like, no, if you forget your place and you pause in trying to remember it, the audience is only going to love you more because it's just going to make them see that you're real, that you're a real person up there. About the only way to bomb at the moth is to come out and give a quote-unquote performance, to get too stand-up-y and kind of talk at the audience. That's about the only thing you can really do wrong.
I personally am terrified of public speaking, and one of the people I've had the fortune of working with in public radio is the great storyteller Catherine Tucker Windham. And the piece of advice she gave me about public speaking and talking in front of groups was that I should keep in mind that everyone in the audience wants me to do well. They're rooting for you to do well, and they're on your side. And having that little change in the way that I looked at it didn't completely solve the problem, but it did help a lot. What sort of advice do you have for people as they're battling stage fright?
It's like I'm sort of famous for this among the people who I worked with again and again. The last thing I say to them before they walk on stage is I remind them to have fun on stage. That might sound crazy, but what we find is that people, when they take them off stage, I'm sure this is true anytime you walk on a stage, you're prepared. You've thought about what you're going to say. You know the beats of it. And so, and you're going out to say it because you want to say it because, I mean, people don't work in public radio for anything but the love, you know. So if you're going out there, you're going out there with love to bring some message to the people that you think they need to hear. And if you can bring joy to that and come out and actually have fun listening to what you're saying yourself, automatically, you're just going to say it the best you've ever said it, and the audience is going to connect with you and, again, sort of lift you up. So I always remind them, I'm like, you've done the work. You know your story. Now just go out, because if you're having fun out there, the audience is going to feel that, and they're going to connect with it. And I think that that's true. For me, like, I have to go out and do pitches. Like, everyone give money. And, you know, no one ever wants to go out and do something like that. But, again, if I walk out there and believe what I'm saying and can connect in with the emotion of why I think that's true, I just find it goes so much better. And, again, to take my own advice, I do occasionally stumble and mess up. But I find that afterwards, people always, it's like they almost love me more because, again, I'm just being real and not out there being some slick monotone, giving it some memorized thing. I don't know if that's helpful, but yeah. Having fun out, I always remind myself to have fun on stage.
That was Catherine Burns with the Moth Radio Hour. Catherine and crew are in Huntsville tonight for the Moth Main Stage, happening right now at Randolph School. Tonight's theme is Save Me. Later this hour, we conclude our discussion about end-of-life issues with the story of a family who said goodbye to their daughter with help from hospice. Up next, it's Planetary Radio and Earth Date. And then coming in August, we rotate two new podcasts in, Engines of Our Ingenuity and 51%. This Public Radio Hour continues on 89.3 Huntsville.
Matt Gollenbeck and 20 Years on Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. We just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Pathfinder lander's arrival on the Red Planet. We're also celebrating the continuous presence of humanity's robots on and above Mars ever since. And I can't think of anyone better to celebrate with than JPL's Matt Gollenbeck, who has been deeply involved in nearly every American mission to Mars over those two decades. Matt will join us in a few minutes. Bill Nye has the week off as he sets out on tour with his brand new book, Everything All at Once. But we've got Bruce Betts to tell us about the night sky and offer some great prizes in the new space trivia contest. We begin by spending a few minutes with the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy, Casey Dreyer. Casey, good to get you back on the regular edition of Planetary Radio. It sounds like the nation once again has a National Space Council, sort of.
Yes, we do. The executive order has been signed. That means we have, at least on paper, a group of individuals, heads of various government agencies that all involve space, an as-yet undefined user advisory group of outside experts, probably industry, representing space interests, and led by Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States, as yet to meet to form some sort of coherent space policy for both military and civilian space in the United States. That is the intention. We haven't had one since the early George H.W. Bush administration back in the late 80s. So it's a step. It's something.
And Pence had some pretty flowery things to say when he spoke at Kennedy Space Center the other day.
He certainly did. And he even touched a piece of space hardware that said, don't touch. But don't worry, NASA said it was okay. But, yeah. he came and, if I kind of was thinking that I were vice president, I would totally go to all of the NASA centers and give cool speeches and see space hardware. That would be a good perk of the job.
I wouldn't have stopped at touching Orion. I'd have climbed inside.
Right. They may have tackled you before you got into that one. But the it's interesting. I mean, he went down to Kennedy Space Center. He gave a nice speech, and that really shows he didn't have to do that. Even as the head of the National Space Council, the vice president is always kind of nominally the head of that since back in Nixon and even before days. I think it does show that he has genuine interest in space exploration, and we should appreciate that and be thankful for that, because that will make our job in promoting space science and exploration a lot easier here in the next 4 to 8 years.
Long ways to go, though. I mean, there are some pretty key members of this group that are still missing.
Notably, the NASA administrator does not exist, has not been nominated, nor confirmed, obviously. And the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the White House has yet to be even nominated. Those are two key positions that we are waiting for. And even, again, if they were nominated, let's say, tomorrow, as we record this, the U.S. Senate, which confirms these positions, is only in service for about another 2.5 weeks before they take a long summer break, the August recess, for about 6 weeks. And then they come back to some pretty heavy political stuff. And we're not even talking about healthcare. We're talking about the budget, debt ceilings, debt limits, and all this other kind of tax stuff. Maybe, who knows? There is going to be a very packed schedule, and we may not see an NASA administrator in the office for maybe even towards the end of the year.
Wow. And it's already a record. We do talk about the National Space Council on the latest edition of the Space Policy Edition. Casey, thanks. I hope people will check out that new extended Space Policy Edition at planetary.org.
Thank you, Matt.
That's Casey Dreyer. He's the Director of Space Policy for the Planetary Society. He and his colleagues doing good work on behalf of those of us who care about the final frontier in Washington, D.C., where all the big decisions are made. We're going to go on now to talking to a guy who has been a Martian for over 20 years, Matt Gollenbeck, about the 20th anniversary of the landing of Pathfinder on the Red Planet. Matt Gollenbeck was the project scientist for Pathfinder, the Mars lander that brought us back to the Martian surface in 1997. As you'll hear from Matt, this marked the end of a decades-long drought. It also reminded all of us just how exciting a Mars mission is, especially one that included a cute little rover called Sojourner. Pathfinder was more a proof of concept than a science mission, but it still did great science, and it did blaze a path for the twin Mars exploration rovers and many other efforts. Matt is now the project scientist for Opportunity, the rover that recently completed a stunning 13 Earth years of activity on Mars. But there are many other missions that benefit from Matt's vast experience on the Red Planet, and he has also played a key role in determining landing sites. He happily accepted my invitation for a return to Planetary Radio and talk to me via Skype from his office at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Matt Gollenbeck, welcome back to Planetary Radio, and congratulations on helping to be a part of not just the beginning, but throughout 20 years of a continuous human presence at Mars. That is quite an accomplishment.
I'm amazed it's happened. It's certainly a pleasure to be back, of course. I often talk of myself as being one of the oldest Martians. So a Martian, I'll define as someone who has done nothing but Mars, and I've been doing that now since Pathfinder development, and that was the first Mars mission in the modern era, and I've been doing that continuously. Well, that's 23, 24 years now.
Without regret, I think, right? Do you ever, you know, look up at Jupiter and think, how come I'm not studying gas giants?
No. Mars is way too cool. Not even close. Europa, you know, being a geologist, Europa's kind of cool, but no, Mars is it.
Yeah. You're a geologist, so it's nice to go where there are rocks and not just gas. Take us back 20 years to the landing of that spacecraft and rover on top of it, because we got to talk about Sojourner as well, and what that marked in terms of essentially a return to Mars.
Yeah, and I think it's actually, I want to take you back to 25 years before, which is a hiatus of almost 20 years in our exploration of Mars. And the failure of Mars Observer, which had happened not that long before. That was supposed to be our return to Mars. And in the Mars science community, I would say a lot of our interpretations were getting pretty stale because there was no new information. A lot of us who were in the planetary program just felt we needed some way to get back to Mars to revitalize our thought processes about what were going on. All of the analysis was based on 20-year-old Viking data, and people have been picking over that for a really long time. We had to get back there somehow.
and we did in style. I mean, it was during that era of better, faster, cheaper, right?
Yeah, that's right. Pathfinder was the first or second discovery mission. It was better, faster, cheaper. It was done for less than the movie you didn't see called Waterworld.
Did it mark this turnaround in our exploration of Mars and, more importantly, our understanding of Mars?
Yeah, I think in both cases, the answer to that's yes. How could you have a MIR if you didn't have a Sojourner? How could you have a Curiosity if you didn't have a MIR? And we certainly wouldn't be thinking of a Mars 2020 rover if you didn't have a Curiosity. And so there's a direct lineage from the Pathfinder rover. It was just smaller, but it's basically the same rocker bogey design. There's not really all that much different. But the way in which we operate a rover on the surface is fundamentally different from the way you operate an orbiter. Or even in some ways a fixed lander, because with a fixed lander, you're in the same place all the time.
Yeah.
Rover, each day that you move, you have to make a decision that's based on what happened the previous sol. And that set up a whole new way of organizing the science team into these science theme groups that would have input. The whole rover can only go in one direction at a time. You can't have the camera guys looking in one direction and the sample guys. Like, everybody's got to be together and organized. And all of that organization of the science team, the way we operated, the main functioning of how we collected data and put it into sample cache, a lot of the hardware, the operating systems on the central computers, all of that was laid out and begun by Pathfinder. So I would say, you know, without Pathfinder as a Pathfinder, it's not clear we would have a Mars exploration program. And that's just talking about it from a technical and scientific standpoint. I think if you add in the fact that this was, in my view, without question, the most popular Mars mission ever. I mean, at that time, this is before the internet was really going, we had front page headlines on every newspaper in America for a week. Hmm. A week. There is no other Mars mission that's had it for more than a day or two. And this was continuous. The whole world was watching us. And we had one day we had trouble with the rover being communicated with and everyone was interested in what was going to happen. It was, you know, did the rover get off today? What did it do? Oh my God, is it getting lost? Is it? And it brought a whole generation to the surface exploration of a planet in a way that's fundamentally different from a flyby or an orbiter. That excitement, that's what gave us a Mars program.
I remember this so well. And the feeling, particularly from Sojourner, that little rover, it was so charming. It was this little pet that was exploring Mars for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And each day you'd look at it, where'd the rover go? What is it doing today? Absolutely.
How did you feel when Sojourner was resurrected for the film The Martian?
lots of fun, lots of fun.
I thought maybe I know JPL helped the filmmakers, right? To get it right.
Yeah, that's right.
That, as you say, was the beginning that you built on to go to the Mars exploration rovers. Opportunity, of course, still very much exploring the surface of Mars. But to stick with Pathfinder for another moment or two, even the MIR spacecraft, even the MIR rovers, we don't want to forget Spirit, though it is now resting in peace, we hope, had the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter looking down from above. You didn't have that with Pathfinder, did you?
Yeah, that's the main difference, is that we had no new information outside of what Viking had collected 20 years before. So if you think about it, you know, I do landing sites as well. We selected a landing site based on Viking images from 20 years before. And the average resolution on Mars from Viking was about 200 meters per pixel.
Wow.
And the engineers are worried about rocks the size of your desk.
JPL senior research scientist and certified Martian, Matt Golombek, will be back with much more after the break. My complete conversation with Matt is in the podcast at planetary.org/radio. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we look at the booming growth of solar and wind power. Great for growing green, but stressing out our ancient power grid. How can our grid get a grip? We'll look at some creative answers, from building neighborhood microgrids to inventing smarter transformers. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Tune in Science Friday every Friday at 1 p.m. on this channel, with a repeat Friday nights at 9 on 89.3 HD3 News Talk. This is 89.3 FM HD1 Huntsville, and you're in the Public Radio Hour. More from Planetary Radio in just one moment, right after Earth Date. Then, learning to say goodbye is never easy, but it's something we must all learn to do. Stay tuned for the final segment of Jenny Kennedy's interview series on end-of-life issues.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Do you have a diamond ring on your finger? If so, take a second to look at it. A diamond is, without a doubt, your most ancient possession. Scientists have shown that gem-grade diamonds were created between 1 and 3.5 billion years ago. The diamond on your finger could be nearly as old as the Earth itself. Diamonds form deep within the planet, 100 miles down or more, underneath the continents. There, the pressure, temperature, and chemistry of the upper mantle create the perfect environment for diamonds at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So how do they get to the surface? Through ancient eruptions. Jets of mantle were propelled by expanding gas, some from 400 miles within the Earth, far deeper than modern-day volcanic eruptions. The eruptions blasted through these diamond zones and carried small quantities of diamonds up with them in shafts we now call kimberlite pipes. But less than 1% of the 6,000 pipes we've discovered have produced diamonds economically. All we see of the pipes today are their carrot-shaped roots, which is where we dig our most productive diamond mines. A smaller number of diamonds erode out of the pipes and end up in streams, beaches, and in undersea deposits. Offshore of Namibia, giant ships vacuum them from the seafloor. The ancient origins of this gemstone give a whole new meaning to the phrase, "A diamond is forever." Perhaps it's no coincidence that diamonds have come to represent everlasting love. I'm Scott Tinker, engaging you with Earth.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. Earth Date is researched by Julie Hennings, written by Harry Lynch, and distributed by Mark Blunt and Casey Walker. For more stories, follow us on Facebook or visit earthdate.org.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. I seriously doubt that there is a scientist who has furthered our exploration of Mars more than JPL's Matt Gollenbeck. Name the mission, and he has probably had a hand in it and helped lead the process of choosing its landing site, if it was a lander or rover. I asked Matt for his take on the most important things we've learned about Mars in the 20 years since Pathfinder arrived there.
From the Viking data, there were hints of valley networks in the ancient Noachian terrain on Mars to suggest that the early environment on Mars may have been wetter. We didn't know how much warmer and how much wetter or how continuous it was. And I would say it was a hint. It wasn't fully accepted that it was wetter. But now, with all of the information we've gotten in the past 20 years, including examples from the surface and from orbit, we have, I would say, unassailable information that rocks were processed into water-bearing minerals on the surface of Mars, that occurred for significant periods of times in which water was at least moderately stable on the surface. And thus the suggestion that the very early history at Mars, at about the same time when life got started here on the Earth, that Mars might have been similar. So if liquid water is the common denominator for life as we know it here on Earth, did Mars have a second genesis? Could life have formed anywhere that liquid water was stable, or are we an accident of the highest order? And that's the kind of question that we can ask from a Mars exploration program in a scientific manner.
Yeah.
I'd say that's about as compelling as you can get.
Let's jump forward to, a few years and really to the present, because of course you are the Mars Exploration Rover Project scientist. Opportunity, as we said, continues to explore the surface, building on what came before. What is Opportunity after now? And what would you say is the legacy of Spirit and Opportunity?
The legacy, I think, is the beginning of having Opportunity land at a location in which we saw clear evidence for evaporites, sulfate evaporites, that occurred in standing water at the surface of Mars in the late Noachian, early Hesperian. I don't see any other geologic model that fits that observation. The fact that Spirit saw water processed rocked in the Noachian highlands of the Columbia Hills, those are undeniable cases of groundwater and even surface water being involved in the genesis of those materials on Mars. Undeniable, in my view. Opportunity has since explored the rim of a Noachian crater and found clay minerals that form in neutral pH conditions, kind of like water that you could drink here now. Unlike the earlier sulfates, which were dominantly acid-rich waters, almost so acid it's more acid than your car battery, there are things that live in that kind of solutions, but there are not a lot of them. And we usually think of the earlier neutral pH waters as being more conducive to the genesis of life. So I think we have clear evidence that water was common early on Mars. And in the earlier period, it was a kind of water that is just fine for life. And so the next question is, you know, were all the elements, were all the things you needed to form life there? Those are kinds of questions that Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity is beginning to take a crack at. And certainly that Mars 2020 is going to have a major stab at with the return of the samples. Eventually, we hope, but also the analytic instruments on board.
Sort of personal question. If you were the NASA administrator and were handed a lot of money for another mission to Mars, let's assume that there is another orbiter, an MRO replacement with communications technology and a big telescope like HiRISE. What mission would you most like to see going to Mars next as a follow-on to what's already happened?
In a sense, the Mars science community has made a statement that the return of carefully collected suite of samples from the surface of Mars would provide the biggest advance in our knowledge, and I don't disagree with that. The difficulty is getting those samples back from Mars and how many additional missions and the cost of those missions to do it. So the Mars 2020 rover will collect and cache those samples. You now need a mission to go and get those samples and put them into a sample return canister and launch them from the surface of Mars, presumably into orbit, the current kind of scenarios. And then you need another mission that would go and collect that sample canister from Mars and bring it back to the Earth. And then you need a sample collection facility on Earth that rivals the Center of Disease Control contamination facility that would cost equally as much as any of those missions to ensure that those materials were kept separate from the Earth. So those are all big ticket items, and how you then begin those steps towards returning those samples are really the difficult part of our planning exercises.
Sample return, I guess if it was easy, everybody would have already done it.
Yeah, and we would have done it a bunch of times too.
I hope that that is still in our future as we continue to explore the Red Planet. Thank you for your long career on that world and on this one. And I hope there are many more successes ahead and that we can talk to you again as we continue the exploration.
I look forward to it.
Matt Gollenbeck, we've been talking with him in his office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he has been for so many years. Currently is the MER project scientist, that's Mars Exploration Rover project scientist. Previously, of course, as the Pathfinder project scientist, but with many other jobs and research efforts underway. He continues to be one of the leaders of our efforts to choose a landing site on Mars for the next rover that we'll visit there, the 2020 rover, which still doesn't have a nicer name. I hope there'll be a nice contest for that.
I'm sure there will.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, and he's back with more about the night sky and other good stuff, and another Planetary Radio t-shirt to give away. The new design, which one of my brothers now has. I still don't have one.
It's really hard to feel sorry for you. I don't know how this happened, but we do like your brothers better than we like you, so that could have something to do with it.
Everybody does. It's just not fair. And he became a member and was able to pick up a shirt, but I'm still looking forward to getting mine. Anyway, you don't have one yet, do you? Better not.
No, but I'm not complaining, am I?
No more complaints. Tell me about the sky.
Well, get up earlier, stay up late, because Venus is just looking lovely in the eastern sky in the pre-dawn, and it's hanging out for the next week or so. It's actually moving past Aldebaran, the bright star in Taurus. So that's something to look for. And on the morning of the 20th of July, the crescent moon will be hanging out near Venus, looking quite lovely. And of course, in the evening sky, we still got Jupiter bright in the west in the early evening and Saturn up in the south in the early evening. And both of them, then up later in the evening. I was so excited about Venus and Aldebaran and the moon, I just kind of petered out.
And t-shirts.
T-shirts. All right, we move on to this week in space history. 1965, Mariner 4 did the first successful flyby of Mars. 50 years later, to the week anyway, New Horizons in 2015 this week flew past Pluto.
And they look remarkably the same. No, not true.
They're both reddish.
Yeah, that's true.
They both have varied terrains. You can make analogies, but they're made of very different stuff on the surface.
Yeah, great milestones. Are you taking requests for random space fact impressions?
Yes, as long as people are okay with how terrible my impressions are.
Here is a request from Gabriel Thielen, or Thelen, in Australia, one of our Down Under fans. There are a lot of them. He says, has Bruce done an Emperor Palpatine random space fact impression?
Are you up to it? I can guarantee I have not. I can... try. I can. I mean, what's the worst that I do? I butcher, you know, the evil dude. So I suppose that's okay.
Go for it.
All right.
Young fool, only now, at the end, do you understand the power of random space pact.
Well done. Well done. I can feel the star system slipping through my fingers as you speak.
Okay. Channeling the power of the dark side. Goodness knows I've got plenty of it.
There you go, Gabriel.
So I'll just give you the fact. This I find fascinating. Pluto's minimum distance from Uranus at 11 AU, 11 astronomical units, is actually less than its minimum distance that it ever has to Neptune at over 17 AU. That's because Pluto is in a 2-3 orbital resonance with Neptune. In other words, Pluto orbits twice for every three orbits of Neptune. One of the implications is that the objects never come that close to each other.
That is a truly great random space fact.
I'll file it under truly great ones.
Yeah, me too. All right, on to the contest.
All right, I asked you, in what year was the supernova observed that formed the Crab Nebula, which you can still see even in relatively small telescopes now? How'd we do?
What I loved about this one is how many people said they didn't need to look it up. What an audience.
Awesome.
Jeff Belback, I think a first-time entry, said that the supernova that would form, eventually, the Crab Nebula, was recorded by Chinese astronomers in, drumroll please, 1054. 1054, is that right?
That is correct.
Jeff, congrats. Nice work on your first outing. And if it's not, nice work anyway. You are going to receive that brand new Chop Shop Design Planetary Radio t-shirt, along with a 200-point itelescope.net astronomy account to do astronomy from home, but using telescopes all over the world on that network that belongs to iTelescope. So have fun doing that. A different Gabriel, actually, Gabe Eggers in Atlanta, Georgia. He said, fun fact, the Chinese called supernovae guest stars due to their bright and temporary nature.
And this evening's guest star will form the Crab Nebula.
You stand back, please. Ilya Schwartz, we hear from him a lot in Columbia, Maryland. It was observed later by English astronomer John Bevis in 1731. The nebula was the first astronomical object identified with a historical supernova explosion, he says. There's also some evidence, according to Ilya, that it was seen in the Middle East, in Baghdad. There was a report made, actually it was a copy of a report that didn't appear until the 13th century, but apparently it was observed back in 1054 from there as well.
All right, here's your trivia question for next time. What other kind of ice forms what appeared to be snow-capped peaks on the top of water ice mountains on Pluto? What's the ice that was found to be forming the covering some of the peaks of the water ice mountains on Pluto? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Good one. You got until Wednesday, July 19 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. Win yourself a Planetary Radio t-shirt, the new design from Chop Shop, the Planetary Society Chop Shop store. You can check that out online. 200pointitelescope.net account, and your very own set of Bill Nye and Planetary Society eclipse glasses. They're the cardboard kind, but they have the certified plastic that you can look through safely when the eclipse comes on August 21st, the Great American Eclipse.
Excellent. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what you would do with force lightning. You know, that stuff that shoots out of the Emperor's hands? What would you do with it? Thank you. Good night.
I'd make toast. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members, who are pretty much all Martians. Danielle Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.
We hope you enjoyed Planetary Radio and Earth Date. Beginning in August, we'll feature two new podcasts in their place, Engines of Our Ingenuity and 51%, an award-winning program that takes an honest look at the professional and social progress made by women. Suggest a podcast you'd like to hear on air. Your suggestions have brought some great ideas to our airwaves, so let us hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and at WLRH.org. In tonight's final segment, we'll conclude our discussion on end-of-life issues. Jenny Kennedy spoke with Christina Johnson, Executive Director of Hospice Family Care in Huntsville. Johnson is a registered nurse whose career was inspired by the death of their 3-year-old daughter, which sparked a dedication to easing the process of dying for others through hospice.
Hospice is about holistic care for the patient, so it's not just focused on the medical, but it's actually focused on the spiritual transition that you go through at end of life, as well as caring for not just the patient, but caring for the families. So that's kind of about what hospice's goal is. It's just that holistic approach to end of life caring, being able to be in a home taking care of your loved one instead of in the acute setting of a hospital.
My one experience with hospice care was my grandmother when she was dying, and those people were angels. It was such a blessing to have them and to be so straightforward and so matter of fact. Why do you think we're so reluctant to talk about this?
I think death scares our society. I think the American culture has created just this fear of death, and that we always have the next fix for someone, and that's just not reality. And so we've created this block of, oh, if mama's sick, we need to take her to the hospital and get everything done possible. And so that patient typically will wind up dying a lonely death, and in all the areas that need to be focused on at end of life, we're not able to be focused on.
And what areas are those that you think society is ignoring in general?
I think that we ignore that a patient knows often when they're dying, so we don't allow them to be able to express their own grief or their own things that they want to say to their loved ones, because we want to kind of filter that out and block it out and not deal with the reality that we're all going to die at some point. I think we don't allow them, by not allowing them to express that, we also do not allow them to go through all the changes and the experience, the spiritual side of how peaceful end of life can be in those transitions. So
I was reading about Huntsville Hospital's services, and we think about death as something that happens to our grandparents, and that's not necessarily the case. And Huntsville Hospital does have a program for grieving parents.
They do. They have the HOPE program, which is helping other parents endure. And that's a phenomenal bereavement service that we actually offer for parents that have lost other children. We also have a childhood bereavement program where we have children helping other children grieve, which is a great program too. There's many services like that we offer to reach out to our community to help them, because again, many people don't want to face the fact that death happens, and we try to not express our emotions like we need to and kind of bury it instead of being able to move forward.
Do you find that you've learned from young children about how to face end-of-life issues?
Yes. Children are very open and honest, and they realize that they're dying too, and they just accept it, and they want you to accept it. And unfortunately, we as parents trying to shelter them from that, and that's not the reality of what a child needs nor what they want often.
With your work with Hospice Family Care, do you have any advice for families who are facing the end of a loved one's life?
I would just say to enjoy the time that you have with people, allow them to live life to the fullest, because it is about the quality of time that you spend with each other and not the quantity necessarily. So don't focus on the medical care all the time. You know, just focus on loving one another and enjoying life.
And what would you say to someone who knows that they're facing the end of their life? What would you have them say to their families?
I would have them tell their families that they love them and it's okay. And just all the things that you have wanted to say to them your whole life, but you didn't feel like you could. I mean, that's going to allow you to have a peaceful death. That's going to allow your family to be okay with your death at that time.
And I know that you got involved in hospice care for a very personal reason. That's something you can talk about with me?
Yes, I would love to. My daughter was 3 when she passed away. And what I realized many years down the road is that we did a lot of things that were unnecessary for treatment. And the 3 years of her life were spent in and out of the hospital, in and out of the units. And what I realized this many years later is that there was a better way, and she didn't have to go through all that. Of course, being a young mom, I thought that I was making the right decisions for her, but a lot of that was simply because I didn't know there were options. And I had a dear friend who was a nurse that looked at me one day and just said, "What are you doing? You know, how long are you going to, you know, let her continue to go through these things that she's going through this aggressive therapies and treatments?" And at the time, I was really upset with her saying that to me. But within a day, it just hit me, like, what am I doing? And she's the one that initially told me about what hospice is. And I was a typical mom that said, "Well, I'm not allowing somebody to come in here and just take care of the child that I've taken care of for 3 years." And she explained to me that they will not do that. You know, that is not what hospice is about. It's just about focusing on, you know, the time that you have with this child or your loved one, and less about the medical attention. You know, they allow you to stay at home, and they come to you to get the treatments that you need and the medications that you need to control her symptoms. And the whole focus is holistic and just focused on managing the symptoms and not having to go rush back and forth to the hospital. So I'm very thankful for my friend that told me about that. And so we were able to have hospice involved for a couple weeks before our daughter passed away. And one of the best things about it was when she did pass away, there was things that I never would have thought about that I needed to do at that time, that the hospice nurse was able just to come in and take over and do for me, such as calling people that I didn't even know to call. And our daughter's death was a very beautiful experience because my dear friend, you know, was able to share that with me, that I needed to get hospice involved with her care. And so what would have happened is our daughter would have continued to go back and forth to the hospital, and she would have eventually been put on a respirator. And my husband and I would have had to make the decision to take her off the respirator. And that's no decision that any parent wants to have to make. But instead, we were able to actually have a beautiful death with our daughter, and we were able to have her die in the bed between my husband and I. And right before she died, she looked up at me and she looked up at my husband, and she passed away. And there was a peace that just filled our home and just overwhelmed us. And it's hard to explain that peace that happened, but it did. And we never would have been able to experience that in a cold hospital room, seeing our daughter hooked up to tubes. So I will forever be thankful to my friend and to what hospice allows you to have through something that's such a tragic event. To lose a child, we were able to have something that was very beautiful and sacred with our daughter. So after she passed away when she was 3, I knew I needed to do something. And I needed to do something that would allow her legacy to continue to go forward. And so I made the decision that I would go back and I would become an RN because I wanted to work in the neonatal intensive care. And the reason I wanted to do that was not necessarily to do the nursing, because I believe that anyone can be trained to be a nurse, but I wanted to be able to minister to other parents that were going through having to make decisions for their children. And I could really relate to them, and I just wanted to be a light for them and let them know it's okay. So that's what I did. I went to nursing school. I went and worked in the neonatal intensive care, just like my dream had been. And the only other thing that drew my attention all through nursing school was my hospice rotation. And I thought I was crazy. I called my husband when I left my hospice rotation, and I said, "I don't know why I like this, but I just so enjoyed being in these families' home and being with them. And it's just such a different environment." And I was like, "That's really weird. I want to be at the beginning of life and the end of life." I'm like, "What's wrong with me?" And my husband just simply said, "I knew that it would be the best thing for you, and you'd love that." And so I continued on my journey for being a NICU nurse, and then I evolved to being cardiac research, and then I went into the pediatric ICU. From the pediatric ICU, I started having the urge to go over to work in the hospice field. So I was fortunate enough to be hired on with Hospice Family Care in 2012, and I was able to be a case manager, which means that I was the nurse that went out and I took care of this caseload of patients. And I was involved in all their care. I help facilitate everything that they receive, whether it be spiritual care, a nurse's aide coming in and helping them get bathed up or helping them eat, you know, whether it be social needs that they need to be met, because a lot of times people don't have their affairs in order at the end because no one thinks they're going to die in our American culture because there's always one more fix. So I was able to do that and just really get to understand that there's such a better way. And I had experienced that with my daughter, but just to see it young and old and in between ages, I mean, it's just amazing the difference of what a home death can be and the peace and the family healing that can take place through this versus, you know, a patient dying in the hospital. And so I was able to do that and just love on families. I oftentimes never even thought about it being as a medical career that I was doing. It was just more of a really getting to love people and just help them with this transition at end of life. And through that, I evolved into compliance. I came in the office and started working in compliance, and then I worked as the director of nursing here for hospice family care and as well as director of operations. And then now I'm the executive director here, and my passion comes from that little girl many years ago that I knew there was a better way, and now I know there's a better way. And you know, the peace that we were able to experience with our daughter and the overwhelming feeling of just having her between my husband and I when she took her last breath, I mean, that's where my passion comes from. I think everyone deserves a good death, and I think that's what our team brings to the table is being able to provide that, not just the medical care and controlling the symptoms, but the actual spiritual side of it and the healing that takes place within the families that can take place. I mean, it's just amazing. And I don't know any other way to describe it. It's just a peaceful, amazing experience that people can have at end of life. And there's just a better way.
And what a beautiful way to honor your daughter's legacy. What was her name?
Our daughter's name is Angela Maria, and we had always called her Angel from the time I was pregnant with her. My husband had said that, you know, we'd call her Daddy's little angel, and at that time we had no idea that she would really be an angel at such a early point in her life. And we love telling people about her. It's just a joy and an honor to be able to continue this mission, you know, long after she's passed away, to be able to continue the mission of just, you know, helping other people and allowing her life, you know, the short little time that she was here, to affect so many others as we've moved forward. Our sons are very aware of death. They're very aware that they had a sister. So it's just I can't describe what she's brought to my life. I would never be on the journey I'm on without her.
That was Jenny Kennedy speaking with Hospice Family Care Executive Director Christina Johnson. Find this interview and resources to answer your end-of-life planning questions at wlrh.org/publicradiohour. This program is built weekly by WLRH staff and volunteers. Tune in next week as we begin an in-depth examination of plans for the future of downtown Huntsville. Have a great night. Thanks for listening and supporting Huntsville Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Yarl Moon, president of NPR. I hope you enjoy the wide diversity of news, music, and entertainment you hear on 89.3 Huntsville, Alabama's original public radio. This community's lucky to have its own public radio station dedicated to your community. WLRH is celebrating 40 years of service, but don't take it for granted. Give today to WLRH.org, then click support, and thank you.